The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. Tuesday, September 22nd, 2020. Restoring regular order here at the Seth Leibson Show. We are delighted to have back with us in studio Lou Holman, his dad, and Hugh. And he usually join us on Tuesday afternoons, but given the holidays and a little travel for other work, Hugh will be back, I think, next week. But we have Lou Holman, of course, with us here today.
Always delight. Always a delight.
Insight Analytics is his company. His website, InsightAnalyticsLLC.com, correct?
Yes, indeed.
And Lewis is the preferred.
Yes.
Lewis.
Either or.
I always think of Lou because of your grandfather. Your grandfather was known as Lou to me. He was my math. He was known as Lou.
Yep.
Yeah.
Lou to me as well.
And Lou to you as well, Grandpa Lou. Happy to take your calls, talking a lot about the Supreme Court, and we will continue to do so in just a few moments. Before we do that, I wanted to get from Lewis any interesting updates on the COVID situation. You've been just fantastic in crunching data for us and questioning other data. So I just wanted to, before we get back to the Supreme Court issue and calls, see what, if anything, you wanted to apprise us of.
So in Arizona, we're having sort of the same kind of mercifully boring several weeks that we've been seeing. Total cases are very, very low. We're seeing about the numbers we saw in early April and in May, just before our real spike kicked in. Deaths, again, continue to fall, which is, you know, obviously very good news. Arizona's RT, the ratio of how many cases each case generates down the road, sometimes called the R-naught, a little bit mistakenly, since that's the initial period.
Yeah.
That has been lower than one, suggesting a decline in caseloads every day since June 22nd, according to RT.live,
right.
Which is very, very good. However, in international news, we're starting to see some different outcomes start to happen. South America, obviously, is still having quite an enormous number of issues, principally in Brazil, Colombia, Peru, and Argentina. So we're still seeing pretty high levels of transmission there. And more interestingly, I think we're starting to see the reemergence of a second wave in Europe, specifically in Spain and in France and then in East Europe and sort of Romania, that kind of area, as well as a little more transmission in the Middle East. So Iran and Israel specifically. That's sort of the big gist of it. But so far in the U.S., things actually are remaining quite stable, even nationwide. So we're seeing about 1,000 deaths a day, which sounds like a lot until you consider that the U.S. has 325 million people living in it.
One of the things I have noticed is more and more research coming out from less and less biased sources attesting to the role of children in the transmission of virus and the need to have the schools opened up. The latest one was, interestingly, Science Magazine. I don't know if you saw that, but Science Magazine, I'll just give you, they came out this week. I'll give you the last paragraph. I'll give the audience the last paragraph. It's three sentences. The role of children in transmission of SARS-CoV-2, that's the way your dad talks about it, right? The role of children in transmission of the coronavirus remains unclear. However, existing evidence points to educational settings playing only a limited role in transmission when mitigation measures are in place, in marked contrast to other respiratory viruses, the flu. In the event of seemingly inevitable future waves of COVID-19, there is likely to be further pressure to close schools. There is now an evidence base on which to make decisions, and school closures should be undertaken with trepidation given the indirect harms that they incur. Pandemic mitigation measures that affect children's well-being should only happen if evidence exists that they help, because there is plenty of evidence that they do harm. That's pretty strong.
I agree. It reflects my position almost perfectly.
Yeah.
The one other interesting thing that I realized today, I was rereading the initial papers just after we sort of learned about coronavirus.
Yeah. Going back to like March or something.
Exactly,
like
right. And so I was reading Neil Ferguson's work,
yeah,
the British
right.
epidemiologist right. who initially predicted bedlam, effectively.
Right. He's the 2 million number.
2.2 million, yeah. Yes, that's him. And so what was so interesting about it is even in his work where he outlines that 2.2 million deaths in the U.S. potential case, the worst case scenario, effectively,
right.
even in that paper, he explicitly advocates against lockdowns,
right.
which
right.
was fascinating to me,
yeah.
especially now that we're here on the other side of this. Now, we've just hit, I think today in the U.S., we've just passed the 200,000 mark
right.
for coronavirus, which is, again, it's a massive number. But again, is not 2.2 million, first
yeah.
of all,
yeah.
And is also, you know, people keep making comparisons between the virus death toll and for instance, wars and the like, which I always find a little spurious
yeah,
just
too.
Because... You know, the median age of death for COVID is something like 78, which is also coincidentally about the median age of death in the U.S. for anything. Like, that's about the average lifespan of an American
right.
at this point.
Right.
And so, you know, even back then, when we're hearing the worst case, we were told not to do any of what we've now done.
Right.
And it's sort of...
Including wearing masks.
Right. But what's so weird about this is that the coverage keeps getting lower and lower and lower grade. I almost never hear about it anymore. It's very hard, you know... It's sort of in the back of everyone's
mind. It's almost
mind
now
at this
just
point.
You know, the only time you almost now hear about it is in a political ad.
Right. No, exactly. And
but of course, we shouldn't politicize the virus, right?
Well, only if
only
we're
one,
Republicans.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yes. Yes. Go on. Go on.
But so you never hear about it anymore, and yet we're still stuck with the mask. We're still stuck with various forms of immobility in our society. We still have all of these issues with school, and so. I keep wondering to myself, when is this nightmare ever going to end?
Right, right.
And
it's become
a
very useful nightmare.
Yes.
For political purposes, I believe. And that's why I've always thought November 4th. I mean, Joe Biden keeps trying to make an issue of it, even as he bungles basic statistics that are just very odd. That's not the main point. That's a main point about his candidacy. But the main point about his pursuit of this as an election year issue is if he's going to do this credibly, I think he has to put forward some kind of credible alternative of what he would have done. And I just haven't heard it.
Well, what's also interesting is that the ads from his campaign that I've been subjected to have all been sort of rolling around with, you know, we need to revitalize the economy,
right.
reopen the
sure.
economy. And it's just like, you're the guys who advocated closing all of this.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Right. Right. Yeah. But I anxiously await. I await agog for him to put forward a credible and clear example of what he would have done differently. As I remind the audience, he was the vice president during the 2009 swine flu, which he does brag about handling so well. And when you go back and read the stories, it wasn't handled well, particularly by him, the press secretary, Robert Gibbs, the Homeland Security director, Janet Napolitano. They had to all cover for him and backtrack on things he said and apologize. I mean, he made a mess of it. It is not a bragging right he has. He's weirdly divorced, I think, from the age that we now live in, having come to age in politics and lived through the age of politics before people had access to information via the internet. And I think he's constantly or continually, or his campaign is, running into the obvious fact that he can't just get away with saying anything he wants anymore.
You know, I do think I agree with that. You know, he's certainly... I think that he's also got another strategy, which is just let the chaos try and be your weapon
right.
and let that
right.
do its job at undermining
let failure speak
governmental
for
response.
Itself.
Yeah.
Right. That's been the...
Which, you know, I can't fault. It's a pretty sound strategy.
Yeah, if you believe in politicizing the virus.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Right. Provided you do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But I don't think it's a very high... highly valued one when it comes to it, because, you know, they do make comparisons to war. You're right about that, at least in the body count. And the difference is, at least through initial phases of war, we don't politicize them. And they have done it from the get-go, starting with the initial travel bans in late January. I mean, from the immediate, they saw an opportunity to use this as a wedge against Donald Trump at every possible point. It became evident to me once I saw CNN allowing to be aired these long-winded, rambling press conferences by Andrew Cuomo, mm-hmm. as his state was engaging in the worst failure of any state while they would maintain the criticism of Donald Trump and other states that had, and governors that had nothing like the record of Cuomo's New York. It was all very clear to me how they were going to use this as a strategy. The Democratic Party on the one hand, and the mainstream media as its communications organ. We will come back with more on whatever you want, but I see we have a bunch of calls on the Supreme Court, and we will do that in just a moment. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Delighted to have Lewis Hallman with us from Insight Analytics, LLC. Also, don't forget to pre-order Dinesh D'Souza's latest film, Trump Card. It exposes what's unique about modern socialism, who's behind it, why it's evil, and how we can help President Trump to stop it. To pre-order your video on demand and DVD, go to watchtrumpcard.com. Now, watchtrumpcard.com. Lewis, I'll get your take, your original thoughts on the Supreme Court debate in a moment, if it's okay. I'd love to go to calls first. And
let's
you
do
and
it.
I can double team them. Steve's in Tempe. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Seth. Hi, Lewis. Wanted to make a quick comment on I wanted to talk to you guys about the Supreme Court nominee, but first I just want to make a quick comment about what you were just talking about regarding the coronavirus and how it's dying down, and it doesn't seem like the Democrats and those against Trump have much to report on it any longer. But the one thing they are reporting now is that the level of 200,000 lives taken by it is reached, and they're using that as a big number and blaming it on Trump. And I thought it was very interesting today listening to Keely McEnany talking about at a press conference talking about that. And the way I thought it was great the way that she and President Trump have addressed it. And their comments are, well, yeah, that's a big number, and the president's concerned about one life in addition to 200,000.
Steve, may I actually give a sort of a historical response on that, actually?
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
So if you look actually at the Spanish influenza pandemic of 1918, back then the population of the U.S. was only about 100 million people, but the death toll that year from the flu pandemic was actually 675,000, literally triple the amount of total COVID deaths with a third of the population. And yet we are told continually, you can't compare this to flu. You're minimizing the danger.
Yeah, exactly. And President Trump's comment to that is that 200,000 is a big number, no question about it. And what you just said, Lewis, is right on as far as the comparison to other diseases too. But his comment was, just think what it would have been if I hadn't done the things that I did do and have been doing and will be doing moving forward to keep this in check. So I thought that was a very strong response on his part and very accurate too. What I wanted to talk to you guys about regarding my thoughts on the Supreme Court nomination, one of the things that's interesting is that it appears they do have the votes right now. And one of the comments that's been going around is, well, since they have the votes, and since, you know, if it is Amy Coney Barrett that gets the nomination and she's already been vetted, why even go through the process? Let's just go ahead and have the vote and get it done with. And I thought that was kind of interesting. But I think President Trump is in a win-win situation with this, no matter who he chooses moving forward, because he said he's going to choose a woman. How great is it going to be to watch the Democrats try to tear down Amy Coney Barrett if it does happen to be her, and have the soccer moms and all the women voters that are planning on voting coming up watch them do that. And hopefully it won't come down to that, but I think the Democrats aren't going to be able to help themselves. They're going to try to do it. I'm glad Lindsey Graham put a three-day limit on the hearings, which I think is good, and I hope they stick with it this time and don't extend it out like they did with Kavanaugh. And I'm sure Lindsey Graham is going to have a very strong, very forceful statement to make opening up these hearings to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I'm sure he will. That's where he does thrive, especially as the chairman of this committee. On the optics, you're absolutely right. The optics are not going to look good for the Democrats. They can't help but not look good when they treat people who appear before these committees who are Republicans. We thought people would remember the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. We're going to have to remind them, and we'll remind them this way. I don't know if people remember the Bill Barr testimony and hearing before the House Judiciary Committee and the way they treated him. They think they're going to go in and get a win. They don't, because, as I was saying last hour, they show themselves as very, very unlikable. That's how they show themselves, because they are very, very unlikable.
Yep.
You know, what did Jeremy Bentham say? The best way to make people comfortable is to make people comfortable, and they make us uncomfortable. It's queasy what they do. I mean, it's stomach churning, and they think it looks good. Maybe it plays a bit to their base. Maybe it's good for fundraising, but it does not win over. It is not a winning look to the American people, and it's not going to be a winning look going into the election.
No question. And Seth, you know, another point that's interesting and very ironic going into this too is Trump's opponent for the presidency has been involved in two very, very controversial, just, you know, flat out, you know, hit jobs on Supreme Court nominees previously, one being Bork and the other being Justice Thomas. And I thought it was interesting how Biden went to tried to issue an apology to
Anita Hill.
Anita Hill. And thank you. And the person he really needed to apologize to is Clarence Thomas.
Well, of course that's right. But what's interesting, and he may not want. Yeah, of course that's right. And what he may not want people being reminded of, which was it's a big deal. Anita Hill didn't accept his apology. You know, the Democrats have to constantly wend and weave themselves between these political identity concerns that they have built tripwires for themselves on. When he came out and announced for president, he then decided that would be the good time to call Anita Hill and apologize to her. And of course, that's back when Me Too was still a very popular concern, a popular issue, the Me Too movement. And she didn't accept it. And I remember Joe Biden going on The View, and I remember him getting beaten up for saying, well, you know, these hearings took place in 1991. What took you so long? You know, kind of convenient that now that you're running for president, you're trying. I don't think he wants that. I don't think he wants people being reminded of his behavior. I don't think he wants people being reminded of a lot of things he's done in either previous campaigns or in previous runnings of the Judiciary Committee when it came to Supreme Court justices. It's just not a good look for him either. Not a good look for him either. I'll get Lewis's and more callers' perspective when we come right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. For energy, health, boosted immunity, and vitality, I want you to check out Balance of Nature. I take it every single day, just vegetarian capsules. A single dose gives you tens of thousands of vital nutrients, over 10 servings of 31 different fruits and vegetables, all the good stuff, pineapples, papayas, spinach, carrots, broccoli, garlic, you name it. And they're keeping this great offer going where they're offering free shipping and 35% off any new preferred order of their fruits and veggies. Those preferred orders are great. It means you lock in wholesale pricing. You can even have a free health coach if you want. Call 800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code BALANCE. We have a dissent, right, Lewis? You're not sure you're on board with how I pitched the answer to Steve.
Well, here's really the crux of my issue, and I guess it's a sort of a minor annoyance with the policy of we're going to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg with a female justice. And I dislike that for two reasons. First of all, it has the effect of making women a genre, which may be a thing over at the Democratic Party, but is not typically a belief that conservatives subscribe to. It also has this sort of reeking of identity politics, where the only way we can think to gain any kind of political points is to play that game as well. Right? The whole point should be that we are replacing this justice with the best justice, right? And so that small...
I fully agree. It's just that Donald Trump has already said it's going to be a woman, but I totally agree.
Right.
Yeah, so we know it will be.
But so here's the other thing. So with that, though, the fact that Trump is nominating a woman, I think, is no defense to him from the Democrats. And the reason I say is
no.
It's no defense to him or the nominee.
Either. He won't get any credit for it.
Well, not only that, but the candidate or the nominee won't either,
right?
Because Democrats don't care about women
Correct.
As individuals.
Correct.
They care about them as a collective.
Correct.
I shouldn't say all Democrats. Many Democrats do.
No, but the left has played this game for years.
Right.
They would say Jean Kirkpatrick and Margaret Thatcher were men. Golda Meir was a man.
Exactly.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And so my issue, I suppose, really, you know, falls into the fact that we're just sort of end up playing their game without any sense of, you know, principle or bearing or frankly, even extra success. Because the fact that I think that he's nominating a woman in light of these factors, it doesn't seem to be helping him much.
No,
because I don't think that the conservative side is going to be overly swayed by that.
No, they're not.
And the left hates him anyway.
You're absolutely right about that. He just didn't need to say it.
No, I frankly would have let it be a woman, and that would have been better.
Well,
because
Amy
then you're not
Coney Barrett, see, this is the problem. She's as qualified as anyone could possibly be in
right.
her own right. And is as qualified as anyone who's ever been appointed in the last, probably by the last two or three presidents. So there was just no need to say it and play that game. I agree with you on that.
Yeah, and how humiliating must it be also, you know, to be told that, all right, you're going to be the nominee, but because we're narrowing our choice down to a woman, we're tacitly, you know, saying it's that there must be a stack of five or six or seven other guys who are better than you.
No, it's a weird thing with the Supreme Court, though. You're right to point out. I mean, I agree with you on the merits. No real disagreement. But it is a weird thing about the Supreme Court nominations is there always seems to have been this game ever since the 20th century, really. There was what once Louis Brandeis was appointed judge, presidents tried to maintain what was known as a Jewish seat. Once Thurgood Marshall was appointed, of course, they wanted to have what was considered a black seat maintained, right? So this game has been applied. They've tried to keep a certain appeasement going with a Catholic or now ever since Sandra Day O'Connor, a woman. That there are several women on the court. Doesn't seem to change that, but it has been a curiosity.
Sure. But it's interesting that you sort of mentioned the history of the court like that. I think we were talking a bit before the show about the recent, in 2013, the move to make the confirmations only require, I think, 50% plus one senators or 51 senators. This is actually the second change to this, I think, since the Constitution was written. Originally, you needed a two-thirds majority. I think it was changed in the 1970s to a 60% and is now the 50-50. The problem with this, in my eyes, is that it has the effect of making it very easy to push your confirmations through when you're in power, but it then creates this very polarized court that gets very, very ugly, that seems to flip-flop rather than needing the old compromise to get a steadier presence.
Hmm. Interesting. It didn't seem to matter to Clarence Thomas or Robert Bork, though, when they had that role, did it?
Well, no, but, you know.
I'm Seth. He's Lewis. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Sam and Sally, they had a great home in Phoenix. It had wonderful mountain views. They needed to sell it, so they listed it with a local agent. After 6 months of little communication and feedback from the agent, and of course no sale, they were increasingly frustrated. But they called James Wexler, and once he listed their home, he marketed it locally as well as on several high-traffic websites and had it under contract within a week. Just like that, of course, the frustration was over. If you're thinking about selling your home, you want to call James Wexler. He guarantees to sell your home at market value, or he will pay the difference. And for maximum convenience, he can also make you an upfront guaranteed offer within 24 hours. Check him out online at jameswexler.com. That's James Wexler, WEXLER.com. Or give him a call at 480-386-0711. Crispin is in Phoenix. Hello, Crispin.
Hey, good afternoon. I tell you, one thing that to me is one of the saddest things, and what we need more of, is I'd like to have civil discussion between the different parties, because what happens is people point out the extremes and they don't talk with the mainstream about policy and stuff. I would love to see more forums where the liberals, conservatives get together and they discuss policy, maybe with some humor and some civility. But what I really wanted to ask you about is the 2016.
What would be a good example of that that you would like to see come back? I agree with you.
I would like to see, for instance, a show that has a co-host. Like, back in the old days, you had
Crossfire, I think, is what you're looking
Crossfire.
For.
Crossfire, that's what I was trying to think about, back in the day. But, something of that nature, and you don't want to be dry. You could still be, something.
God, I thought that was such blood sport weird. I did not. I don't have the same memory.
That's not what I would recommend. But that's something of where people, they have some humor. They have some respect for each other.
I kind of like Firing Line. I've been watching old Firing Lines on YouTube.
Oh, those are fun. Those are fun. Even though I disagree with Buckley 90% of the time, but they were entertaining and kind of a Dick Cavett sort of.
He let you talk and there wasn't really any shouting. I kind of liked that.
I wish they would go back. I like, for instance, with you, I'll give you credit for that.
Thanks.
You're more intellectual, and you don't call yourself. It's not self-aggrandizement, like calling yourself the Great American or the Sage or it's the whole thing. I say if someone is beautiful or strong, they know it already. They don't have to brag about it.
Some people do it for the marketing, but anyway, I take the compliment.
Let me get to my point, though.
Sure.
I guess we only have
a
limited time.
Sure.
Is that the 2016? The main problem I have with it, and it's fine if you're against the other side, you want to vote, or urge your people not to vote. As a House leader, though, to me, it should at least come up for a vote. I think House, and as Republicans and Democrats, the
you mean
House
Senate?
Leader,
do you mean Senate? To... You mean Senate? You mean Senate?
Yeah, the Senate. Well, Congress in general, though. The leaders have too much power to block legislation. I think once it's voted by the committees and stuff, it should be brought up for a vote. You can, but the same thing like with that's what I want to ask you morally. And do you also think it was what the founding fathers wanted? What McConnell did in 2016 to not even bring it up to a vote? That's the problem I have with it. Not the result, that you're for this or that.
Sure.
The problem
sure.
was, and that's why us Democrats are livid, and sure. it's gonna come back on you guys in a lot of ways. It's also definitely energizing, so that may be a helpful side of it, but. From our view, it's outrageous. I don't even know how to express it.
Well, I understand that. If you want, you can hear me out on my monologue on it yesterday. It's available on YouTube.
I spent about ten.
No, that's okay, but it's available on YouTube.
Okay.
Let me ask you a question. Is there equal outrage over the shifted position that the Democrats now have and the change of statements they're making, saying wait for the election, which is the opposite of what they were saying in 2016.
Well, I think we know legally the president always has a right to propose, et cetera. To me, that's just politicking. But regardless of what this us versus them type of mentality, once again, the important thing to me, the problem was did what he did in 2016 was not right, regardless of whether you think he should or not wait.
I understand the point. I understand the point. The question I'm trying to ask you is,
I wouldn't do it.
Why
personally?
I wouldn't
argue that.
Not the question I'm asking, Crispin. You said we were going to talk and listen and talk, right? Let me talk. You're not
got
hearing
it,
me.
It.
Okay. I'm asking
I'm
you, why is it easy to go into such high dudgeon and say, well, we are livid because the Republicans are taking a different tack, when the Democrat from 4 years ago, when the Democrats are taking a different tack presently? The hypocrisy could be argued on both sides. Now, there is a distinguishing characteristic having to do with split party positions in 2016. That is a characteristic. That having been said, why are only the Republicans to be blamed if you wash that distinguishing characteristic away and not Democrats? They clearly changed their position on this, too.
Didn't say nothing
well,
of the 2013
if,
shift.
Well, I know what's consistent on their part is if one party can do it, why should the other party be able to do it? So it's, to me, it's kind of goofy to see Republicans attacking them for doing a similar thing, but it's wrong on both sides. It's not helpful. But what I'm saying is back to, once again, my question was it morally right, and it was what the founding fathers wanted by him to not bring up a vote at all, to bring up, not even bring up a vote.
Yeah, I was
of,
I,
yourself,
well,
I,
you asked a fair question. Well, you, yeah, yeah, you asked a fair question. And
That's my main point.
Yeah, you asked it. And as I said, I was of mixed mind then. I didn't think it was a wonderful position. I don't think it's a wonderful position today, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it does
I think
matter.
Your point.
Morals matter.
Crispin, it was a certainly legal thing. I don't think it was immoral. I don't think it was immoral to say that in a divided Senate and presidency in an election year, we can allow the people to decide any more than it's moral or immoral for Mitch McConnell to say now the American people.
So what changed McConnell's mind?
If you're not going to let me finish the sentence, we can't do this.
Well, you have more time. Go ahead. You have the power. Go ahead.
I gave you the power to ask your question and let me answer
it. I haven't heard an answer from you yet.
Okay. Thanks, Crispin. My answer is that you can play Hatfields and McCoys all day long. Mitch McConnell made the point in 2016 that when the American people kept increasing the Republican majority on the Senate, which they had done from 2014 to 2016, including into 2018, that it should be left up to the American people to vote on the president they wanted to nominate. Now, is it a great moral argument? Not necessarily. Is it a good political argument? Maybe. The Democrats are in that exact same position. The fact is, it does not matter. The president has the right to nominate, and the Senate has the right to confirm or deny. Thank you for spending some of your afternoon with us. Lewis, you wanted to weigh in on this whole issue of these charges of hypocrisy going back and forth. Go for it.
Yeah, I mean, both parties are pretty obviously resolute hypocrites in this regard. I think it should be obvious to anyone. Now, the question is that, well, you need the consent of the Senate, and you need the president to do the appointment. If we're both whinging hypocrites, then what does the document say? Well, the document says that the president gets to nominate someone and the Senate can get to vote on it. That's the policy we ought to do. However, I would also say that if we hadn't weakened the nomination process anyway, going from 66 votes to approve to 51, then we would have to compromise. I actually totally disagree with Crispin's point that I actually think we need more barriers to passing legislation, because that will force more compromise. Because so much of what has been happening in the last two decades of American political life is one party gets a temporary majority in whatever field we're talking about, and then they spend the entire time they have that majority cramming their desires, whatever they are, down the opposition's throat. And then the opposition storms back in, creates a vengeance, and then they hammer back. There is no maneuvering. There's no goodwill. It really is, you know, Hatfields, McCoy, or Hoodoos versus Tootsies, you know.
Yeah, I guess I've never liked the supermajority rules outside of the constitutional mandates for them, because I thought it did not allow for majorities. And I thought it was so anti-majoritarian that it didn't allow for a party to put forward its platform and proposals and subject itself to the 2- and 6-year plebiscites on whether they were to be approved or not. It's a confusing thing to require. To me, it's a confusing thing to say in a body of the House, or really more importantly and more regularly in the Senate, that a majority doesn't control. I don't know that we had more compromises with the 67-vote requirement. You'll recall how many of the nominations were stalled by Harry Reid with it, and how bitter some of the fights were under it, including, you know, Nixon's three nominees. Reagan had some, Bork certainly, Clarence Thomas. But I do think the argument that the Senate should provide advice and consent was absent in 2016, and it ain't here, and that might be a distinguishing characteristic.